from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, and for the Pacifica Radio Network, this is The Beloved Community. The website is progressivespirit.net. Resources for activism, for creating Martin Luther King's vision of the beloved community. My name's John Schack. This is the election edition. I have three guests today. I speak with Lawrence Lamer, author of The President's Butler, a fictional account of a billionaire who decides to run for president. Professor Mark Lewis Taylor of Princeton Seminary has written a couple of articles for Counterpunch in which he lays out the case for defeating both Trump and Clintonian neoliberalism. Finally, to change the pace, I speak with visionary artist and sacred activist Amy Livingstone. Through her work as an artist, she explores the intersection between religion, ancestral ways of knowing, and spiritual ecology. I begin with author Lawrence Lamer. He's written about the Kennedys, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Morris Deves, and in his latest novel, he takes on a certain billionaire who's running for president. His novel is The President's Butler. Welcome, Mr. Lamer, to the Beloved Community.
Thank you.
Now, the story is about Vincent Victor, a billionaire showman who runs for president, as told through the eyes of his butler, Billy Baxter. Trump really did have, or does have, a butler.
He did have. He retired, and Tony got in a lot of trouble because in Facebook he said how the President Obama should be assassinated, and not a smart thing to do on any level, and he got in a lot of trouble for that. So my butler is not Tony Seneca. My butler Billy Baxter would not say or think anything like that.
No, he's pretty soft-spoken, we find, mostly throughout the novel.
Yeah, well, he's this guy. He's this working-class guy from upstate New York, and he comes from a poor family. His mom has a little grocery store there, and he gets a chance to work in this incredible mansion up there in the upper Hudson River Valley and become a footman. And that's true. That Tony Seneca actually started as a footman in Mar-a-Lago, so that much is true. And anyway, becomes a footman, and he advances and becomes a butler, and he identifies with this old aristocratic British life. And then who comes and buys the estate but Vincent Victor, my Trump lookalike? And the butler, Billy, goes to work for him, and it's totally different. It's a wild, wild, flamboyant man, and it's a very different kind of life. And Billy is the great observer, the working-class guy, working in this house and observing this guy and describing him and understanding him.
Billy Baxter, his butler, says of Vincent Victor that he is living as a surrogate for the majority of the American population, living the way they would if they had great wealth. Is there a truth to that with Donald Trump?
Well, what it is that he doesn't live the kind of the understated old aristocratic idea of the Boston Brahmins, for example, and of the British upper class. They're kind of understated people. He's flamboyant, and in the novel, everything is gold, everything is overdone, and that, in Billy Baxter's idea, is how poor whites, if they were rich, that's what they'd want. They'd want to have gold everywhere. They'd want to have this incredibly flamboyant lifestyle. So in that sense, he is living their life.
All the gold for his chandeliers, for the Victor's golden castles. These are malls that the character in the novel is building. And yeah, he purchased these chandeliers, and it really shows how Victor does business. Can you describe that scene?
Well, and this is very Trumpian as well, because I know in West Palm Beach that Trump will have these small business people, and he'll get some contract with them. And it comes time to pay them, and he's going to pay them half, or he's not going to finish through. And he says, "You know, screw you. That's it." And in the novel, this Armenian businessman in Jersey City goes over and gives him this contract to have these chandeliers, biggest contract the guy's ever had. He's so excited, but you know, Trump talks him down in the price, gets him at a low price, and the guy delivers all the chandeliers, and he comes to get the last third of the money. And Vincent Victor says, "I'm not paying you. Your chandeliers aren't any good. They're terrible. I'm gonna either return them, if I put them up on the ceiling, people won't see how shoddy they are. You got a choice. I'm either gonna return them to you, or I'm not gonna give you the rest of the money." And the poor guy walks away. And in the novel, he does that again and again to people. And Billy Baxter He's a, you know, white working class guy, and he doesn't like this. And the Vincent Victor character just insists that Billy Baxter be there every time he does that. That's what he's going to do. He considers that's what a businessman does. It's just right that he's doing that, and he wants to stick it to him.
And is there a parallel then with the way Donald Trump does business?
Exactly. I mean, he actually did it with a chandelier. He did it. I'm sitting here, I can see on Southern Boulevard, I can see this store that he did. This is exactly what he did to that guy in that store. It wasn't for all the chandeliers as there is in my novel, but that's what he does.
If you're just joining us on the beloved community, my guest is Lawrence Lamer. He's the author of a new novel called The President's Butler, a look at the life of Vincent Victor, who is a billionaire who decides to run for president, who may sound familiar to another person we know in real life. Why did Vincent Victor run for president? Because his business is failing. Is that right?
Yeah, he builds these Victor's Golden Castles, these upscale-looking discount malls where he goes to China and he gets these they look like designer clothes, but they're not. They're cheaply made. And he sells them in these fancy, in these malls, and they're all over the country. And he builds them up, and he builds them up. And as he builds them up, he gives people these credit cards. So these generally, you know, lower middle class people are coming to these malls, they're getting the credit cards, they put thousands of dollars of debt on the credit card. And in some ways, the mall is a sham. They're really selling debt. And it has to build, it's like a Ponzi scheme where it has to build bigger and bigger and bigger to succeed. And he's reached the point where he's got them all over the United States. He can't build anymore. And he's getting publicity. He's got a couple of television shows. And the publicity draws people into the malls. But he needs more publicity. So he decides, well, I'll run for president. It's not going to cost me much. I'll get on the tube. I'll get a lot of attention. And that'll help my mall, help the malls. And then the thing takes off. He can't imagine it's going to work, and he takes off and becomes a Republican candidate.
And that sounds a little bit similar to our real-life fellow, doesn't it? Make
sure
money
does.
And gain celebrity?
Yeah, exactly.
I often wonder, he can't lose, in a sense. If I'm talking about the real Donald Trump now. If he wins on November 7th and we wake up to President-elect Donald Trump, Trump wins. But if he loses, he still wins.
Yeah, and you know what? He's going to have his own Trump television network. He's going to be enormous. He's going to be a major figure in American life for the next decade, no matter what happens.
And a couple of his TV shows. Now we're going back to the novel again with Vincent Victor. He has the Vigilantes and the Great American Breast Contest. Talk about those for a second.
Well, the Great American Breast Contest comes first. I mean, the real Trump, you know, has this beauty contest, and he's obsessed with part of the female anatomy. And so he's with a couple of his buddies, and they're watching one of these contests, and you know, he said, it's just about breasts, that's what it is, why are we watching? And he gets the report of the shows, and he shows that whenever the camera focuses on one of the contestants' breasts, the rating goes way up. So he has this idea, calls the Great American Breast Contest. And originally, he can't get it on one of the major networks. He has it on the lowest of the low networks, but it gets such great ratings that it goes on NBC. And for 5 years, he hosts the Great American Breast Contest on TV, which is not too far away from reality. And then NBC, and NBC is in the dumps, and that's why they put that show on. And then they want him to do a show called The Vigilantes. It's a show where they go out and they go against injustice, and they go about these injustices in the world, and they come and confront them, and then Vincent Victor goes, and then the last moment comes and confronts the malefactor. And it's not done by the journalistic part of NBC. It's done by the entertainment division. And they have this group of young people that from all different races and different costumes that are going to be the vigilantes. And Vincent Victor says, that's okay. But when they leave the room, he says, no, I want to have 10 blondes. We want blondes. And the person who's doing the research for NBC says, rightfully so, that, gee, these blondes, we get rating for blondes. Blondes are taking over everything. So let's go ahead and have the 8 blondes as the vigilantes. And so they do, and it becomes an immensely popular show.
What does Donald Trump really care about?
He cares about himself. he cares about that. That's true with Vincent Victor in this character. It's all about him. And Vincent Victor is kind of envious of everybody. Everything, wants everything. He thinks he deserves everything. And there's a quality of that in Donald Trump, too. People think he's doing these things off the top of his head and doesn't know what he's doing. He's very calculating what he's doing. He knows this is going to advance him.
He calculates everything, even his marriage, in terms of what value it will bring to him.
Right, right. He's just totally self-absorbed. He's the ultimate creature of our culture.
The ultimate creature of our culture. Envy is one of the things that Billy Baxter mentions about Vincent Victor. That at one time, Victor says that it's better to have people think you've had sex with a beautiful woman than to actually do it.
Right. Well, envy is, in some ways, the preeminent. It's a preeminent feeling in American culture. If you succeed, I don't say, "Wow, that's great. You're terrific. You've worked out. You've got. No, I'm envious. Why isn't it me? Why isn't it me? I don't think maybe I don't have the abilities. Maybe I didn't work hard enough. Maybe I'm not lucky. I'm just upset that you're there. You're where you are, and I'm not there."
So coming up on November 6th, what do you think is going to happen with this election?
I think it's going to be very close, very close. Business guy Alan Lechman, he's a professor at American University. He's called the election right for the last 30 years. He's a kind of moderate. He's a Democrat probably, and he thinks Trump's going to win. It's going to be close.
That was my original interview with Lawrence Lamer about the president's butler a few weeks ago. Then this happened.
I gotta use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the. I can do anything.
Well, now with the new videotape that has come out about Donald Trump, do you still feel that he has a chance? Has he gone over the top in terms of his outrageousness?
No, I think that with these tapes, it's so deplorable, so outrageous. That will do. We've seen what's happening in the polls. And he had an opportunity in the debate to truly say he was sorry. He didn't do that. He didn't do that. And he went on this offensive. And I think what's going to happen is so much is going to be torn down in the next month before the election. I mean, Clinton will win. But what will she win? She's going to be so scarred, so slimed, that what will her presidency be like? And I just think this country is headed for a very unfortunate time.
Because he's going to spend, sounds like, his last month just going on the attack, just for the sake of the attack.
You know, it was interesting in the debate. I mean, first of all, it was supposed to be a town meeting and people to have their say. And it wasn't as much of that as it should have been, because these journalists always have to be prominent. They didn't allow it. But even when they did that, it was interesting when they'd asked Trump a question, like that young Muslim woman asking him a question about how Muslims are treated. He doesn't talk to her. He just pivots and talks to the camera. The same with the questions to him. He doesn't have any human contact with anyone. He's a creature totally of the media, a creature of the tube. He's brilliant at that, but he's gone as far as that as he can get. And he's got his hardcore supporters who are even more defiant, but he's going to lose overwhelmingly.
And is that similar also to the character of Vincent Victor?
Yeah, well, Vincent Victor is a lot smarter than Donald Trump. If Donald Trump did what Vincent Victor did, he might well have been elected. But Vincent Victor, in the end, has more self-control than Donald Trump does. Trump is so egomaniacal beyond imagination. His attitude toward women, it's always just about him. No one else is in his life except for Donald Trump.
In this case, reality is more strange than fiction.
No, and that's why in my portrayal of Vincent Victor, I knew that if I made it, that Trump is a satire himself. So I couldn't become more satirical. I couldn't become more exaggerated, as people have done in trying to satirize Trump. So I pulled it back a little and have a somewhat more realistic portrait, which I think helps us understand the phenomena of a Trump-like person and where it leads us.
And one more time, tell me, what is the phenomena of Trump in regards to American culture today?
Well, Trump takes all these disparate things that began quite a while ago. For example, the obsession with celebrity. He has something with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I know Schwarzenegger well because I wrote about it. He has the disenfranchised white working class that went from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. What does he know about them? George Wallace, who was the original person to go after that constituency, was a member of that class. I mean, Trump doesn't know these people. He's hardly ever talked to them in his life. But he's such a shrewd person that he's been able to take these things together and build this phenomenal campaign.
Lawrence Lamer has been my guest on The Beloved Community. He is the author of the novel, The President's Butler. Thank you so much for this novel and for your insights about Donald Trump.
Okay, thank you very much.
From Trump to Clinton, is there as much a difference as we might think? Professor Mark Lewis Taylor of Princeton Theological Seminary says, not so much. We'll talk about two articles he wrote for Counterpunch, in which he says the time is now to defeat both Trump and Clintonian neoliberalism. Next. Mark Lewis Taylor is the Maxwell M. Upson Professor of Theology and Culture at Princeton Theological Seminary. We're going to discuss articles he wrote for Counterpunch, one in July called The Time Is Now to Defeat Both Trump and Clintonian Neoliberalism. Then in September, it was followed with another article, Fearing Trump and Voting Clinton, Some FAQs. Welcome, Professor Taylor, to The Beloved Community.
Thank you, John. Glad to be talking with you about this.
Well, tell me a little bit about your intent for these articles.
Yeah, well, both of them, when begun back in July and continuing throughout the electoral season, and I was thinking many of these thoughts from the very beginning as Trump began his love affair with the media and began to rise in the Republican polls, that we need to see Clinton and Trump as sharing some common ground. And I was trying to make that point against the common assumption that they are a binary, when in fact I see, as I argue in these two pieces, that Trumpian authoritarianism and Clinton's neoliberalism, as it's often called, and we can talk about that term later if you like, Trump's authoritarianism and Clinton's neoliberalism are actually co-partners in one system of rule, of U.S. imperial rule and domination by U.S.-led capitalism in the present time. Trump's authoritarianism is often a bitter fruit of the kind of geopolitical order and rule that Hillary Clinton and the corporate elites of our time often champion and defend.
Yeah, you mentioned in there that Trump is really the result, in a sense, of this neoliberalism of Hillary Clinton and her predecessors.
Yes. And let's do clarify this notion of neoliberalism, because it's often used very quickly and easily on the left, and we often don't say what we mean by it. It's a word that has come to stand for coercive U.S.-led capitalism. And it's usually a form of economic arrangements between the U.S. and other countries, but also within the U.S. increasingly, that backs up exploitative economic policies with force, military force, carceral police force, surveillance tactics, and the like. Some people call it militarized imperial capitalism. And to make that work, you need both smooth-talking corporate elites that use democracy language, free market language, when in fact the market is not free, and so on. But then you need to back it up with the authoritarian figure. And Trump is that. He looks like the bully that has been at work in many other countries as allies of the United States around many parts of the world. So without saying that Trump and Clinton are identical, I have been trying to make the point, and it's a difficult one to get lodged in the public mind, that they are co-partners in this joint system of rule.
I was thinking it's almost like the same empire with two different faces. If I was coming from another planet to see this action, for example, after the debate, just kind of a Jerry Springer show, it seems like we're all set up to be duped.
Well, in a way, yes. I was thinking about the second round of debates between Trump and Clinton that we saw just last night. We're speaking the day after here. And on the video screen, you saw one candidate, Hillary Clinton, returning to her cushioned stool to sit politely for the most part and wait her turn to speak. And then you saw a menacing, prowling, bellicose Donald Trump in the background with the familiar jutting jaw. And while it looked like a study in contrast to many Americans looking at the screen, for many poor countries and poor communities in the United States, that combination of the smooth elite and the authoritarian figure are experienced simultaneously. They have different roles and have different functions at times, but a similar goal of maintaining a certain kind of rule. And this is why I argued that we need to defeat Trump and Clinton together. And ways that we do that will change, of course.
Well, the difficulty, of course, is that we are getting the message. Those perhaps who voted for, say, Bernie Sanders or want something like you're suggesting to say, well, it isn't the time now because we have to get rid of the really bad one. That that there's no time for the third party kind of setup right now because we've got Supreme Court justices at stake and so forth, that that Trump is the greater evil. What do you say to those arguments?
I say that, first of all, I understand it. I am not one that ridicules the person who feels like the authoritarianism of Trump is the greater evil. Actually, the greater and more massive evil, I think, is the neoliberalism that continually deploys and brings Trump to other lands and then brings him, as we have it this year, to the U.S. mainland. And if someone thinks that they have to throw a Clinton vote at Donald Trump to take out someone who increasingly has become identified with the worst of supremacist leagues in our society, such as the Fraternal Order of Police, which has endorsed him, and other white supremacist groups, if they feel that they have to throw their Clinton vote at Trump, well, so be it. If that's the case, though, then on November 9th, after the elections, we need to work to forge an alternative party that will oppose Hillary Clinton's neoliberalism, because otherwise we're going to get more Trumps coming down the pike and maybe some more effective ones that can consolidate rule better than Trump has so far been able to do.
I'm speaking with Mark Lewis Taylor, who wrote a couple of articles for Counterpunch. One is The Time Is Now to Defeat Both Trump and Clintonian Neoliberalism. He wrote that in July, and then in September followed it with Fearing Trump and Voting Clinton, Some FAQs. At the beginning of your first article, you made a quote, you posted a quote by Mumia Abu-Jamal that says, if Trump is the price we have to pay to defeat Clintonian neoliberalism, so be it. So I'm kind of wondering about this. If now, a few weeks before the election, you're saying that you understand if someone who throws a Clinton vote against Trump to stop him, are you not now admitting that Trump is or has become a price too high to pay for defeating Clintonian neoliberalism?
Yeah, that's a good question. I like it. I think it's important to remember, though, that as I said in my article originally, these are the kind of issues because of changes in the political deep terrain below the elections as well as in the elections. Ultimately, history is going to have to complete the writing of my essay, and I still believe that. So there are two points to make, though, about what history has given us since the July writing of my essay. First, among many developments, the movement of Republican corporate elites over to Democratic Hillary Clinton has allowed Trump to stand, indeed forced Trump to stand, in a new light. He has to, namely, appeal to and consolidate the white alt-right, as it sometimes concerned. And by the white alt-right, I mean a force of white supremacist repression that is organized within the police, within prison guard units, and white militia ranks across the country. They've already, of course, grown strong under Bush and Obama. But without the cover of the Republican elite's democracy language, and without the cover a lot of the neoliberal phrasings that those corporate elites share with the Democrat corporate elites. So I can understand that with him grown strong in that new way, without the Republican elite backing that he had at an earlier point and that it looked like he might have, many would think that it is best to parry him on November 8 and push him back underground along with his white bullies and gangs. So that's an important point. It makes me understanding a new development. But then secondly, I would say this. In a way, the American people have already paid a price, paid the price of having Trump around, even without a Trump presidential regime. He has sullied the entire electoral process. Even mainstream media types talk about the ick factor, the brutal kind of rogue display that he puts on, and indeed the kind of retaliatory language that Clinton has at times used. They both have descended into an abyss that many see as a very high price indeed for the American people to have paid. But also, even by the time of the second debate, Clintonian neoliberalism has taken some hits from Trump. Trump has gotten in some critiques that are not without foundation, as inexcusable and outrageous as his sexual assault language was, which he tries to diminish as locker room talk. He's not wrong to point out that there's been misogyny in Democratic regimes and even in the White House under Bill Clinton, and he's been caught at it right in the Oval Office. He's not wrong to point out, as Vijay Prashad, a scholar, stresses, that ISIS is a product of U.S., Iraq, and post-Iraq policy under the time of Obama and Clinton. He's also not wrong that Hillary Clinton and the neoliberal Democrats also take tax loopholes. Her donors, her friends, expect her to maintain some of those loopholes as she goes into office. So he's not wrong to point that out. All that is to say that Clintonian neoliberalism has taken some hits as the American people have paid to watch this Trump figure do his will, and Clinton has not come off looking well. It's interesting to me that right now the Twitter campaigns, the hashtags about first sexual assaults and all, this is a very important and positive development in some ways, but the rage is powered largely by white man Trump having violated predominantly white women. And I have to ask, as a person who knows Central America over the years and knows how Hillary Clinton's Honduras policy, for example, has resulted in massive sexual assault and torture of women and their families and many others. It's almost as if the daily sexual assault and torture that makes up the business as usual of Clintonian neoliberalism doesn't matter to white people in the United States. It's only when a rogue figure like Trump stands up and shows his not only ugly side, but inexcusable and prosecutable side, that then it is said that Trump's campaign is imploding and has to be organized against. So that development is very important. I think Clintonian neoliberalism has already been damaged by the price the people have paid to have Trump where he is.
Mark Lewis Taylor, my guest, professor of theology and culture at Princeton Theological Seminary. Talk about that background of your academic background, the work that has inspired your thought here.
Yeah. First of all, as a Christian theologian, I have a mode of political thinking that pivots around an interpretation of the crucifixion of Jesus as a political event. The crucifixion was Rome's primary way of removing politically critical or politically inconvenient upstarts, and thousands were so removed. It's no accident that Professor James Cone of Union Seminary strikes an analogy between lynching and the cross. Both were public service announcements that said, act up, step out of line, or this is what the imperial state will do to you. So these political issues are not tangential to my understanding of what being a theologian is. More experientially, if I could just give two examples, since the 1970s, I've been involved in prison activist work, and I have seen progressively what's happened across the decades of the 70s and 80s and 90s into our current period, where we have a 4 to 6-fold increase in our prison population. Indeed, not just the mass criminalization of a population, but the emergence of a carceral state or prison nation, as we often see. So I know how central the democratic regimes have been to building that up, as much as, if not more than, the Republican law and order ideology. I've seen that from inside the prisons and in my work in prison activist movements. And then since the 1980s, I've looked at U.S. policy from the perspective of Central American nations, primarily Guatemala and South Mexico. I've intentionally tried not to just tour around from country to country, but to kind of dwell in these places to look at what U.S. policy was doing to people's everyday life on the ground. And so I am burdened with a certain sense that it's a destructive modality of rule and governance that the U.S. sustains within itself when it comes to the needs of dispossessed and struggling peoples, both abroad and at home.
Yeah, this program is called the Beloved Community, of the idea of resources for activists, theory as well as practice in terms of building Martin Luther King's vision of the beloved community. And I wanted to ask you if you might contrast King's vision of the beloved community and Clintonian neoliberalism.
For me, as you can gather from my previous remarks, there is a chasm between the vision of community advocated by Martin Luther King throughout his career, but especially towards the end, and what we call neoliberal Clintonism today, or Clintonian neoliberalism. The latter is about an agenda set by the elites of the global north and proxies that they can siphon off across the globe. King's vision of the beloved community was for the whole community of humanity, but began with, and this is a point stressed by Cornel West very well in his book, The Radical King, the beloved community began by acts on behalf of the radically unloved. In other words, it works from those who have been dispossessed, in our day, dispossessed by the neoliberal global regime. That's the way you build beloved community, out of solidarity and movements for the radically unloved. That Clintonian neoliberalism does not do. But the powerful force, I believe, both as theologian and as political strategist, is born from the communities and solidarities forged among and with the radically unloved.
Are there significant differences, though, between Clinton and Trump, or say Clinton and any one of the others who could have been elected, Paul Ryan, for example?
Yes, I guess I would go back and highlight what I alluded to at several points, is that Trumpian authoritarianism tends to speak the language of leadership, of authority, of powerful rule, and it tends to dispense with the neoliberal phrasings of democracy, of progress, of humane development. Which is all through the language of Clintonian neoliberalism. Interventions are called humane, even when they take out large numbers of citizens. Assistance to poor countries is called humane development, even though more money ends up coming back into the coffers of the lending nations of the North than actually stays in the country for the poor of those countries. In other words, Clintonian neoliberalism is better at the sleight of hand that leads many American citizens to think they're engaged in a democratic, developmental assistance project for the globe instead of the exploitation that, in fact, it is. The Trumpian authoritarians will be more comfortable with simply talking about a great America, and it has its greatness, even if it has to sacrifice people to get to that position of greatness.
Okay, it's Wednesday after the election. Clinton gets in, as it looks likely. What is the action now that needs to be taken to stop the most horrific aspects of Clintonian neoliberalism?
Indeed, and that means working with wherever the Sanders supporters have gone, wherever the Green Party folk are who need to work more closely with the Movement for Black Lives. It means enabling the Movement for Black Lives and Asian and Latinx peoples to work together against neoliberal capitalism, and parties like Socialist Alternative and others that have been completely off the map of conversation in all of this back and forth about Trump versus Clinton.
Mark Lewis Taylor, author of The Time Is Now to Defeat Both Trump and Clinton Neoliberalism. That was came out in July. And then in September, a follow-up with Fearing Trump and Voting Clinton, Some FAQs. Professor Taylor, thank you so much for being with me today.
All right. Thank you very much, John.
Next, we take a deep breath and move from politics to sacred art, spiritual ecology, and activism for Earth. Amy Livingstone of the Sacred Art Studio is up next on The Beloved Community. Livingstone is the proprietor of Sacred Art Studio in Portland. Her website is sacredartstudio.net. Amy explores the intersection of theology, ancestral ways of knowing, environmentalism, and spiritual ecology. Her work is informed by her love for the earth and engagement with many forms of creative expression that include painting, sculpture, installation, and ceremony. She's had formal education in creation spirituality and sees her work as transformative as we face an ecological crisis that Amy calls a spiritual crisis. Welcome, Amy, to The Beloved Community.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How did your studio and your work, the Sacred Art Studio, get started?
I founded the studio in 2003, originally, but the vision came forward during Joanna Macy Intensive. It was in 2002, actually. So I was there for a 10-day training and had a really profound experience, a mystical experience of my own that was what I call a homecoming to my place in the web of life. And so at the end of the 10 days, we took vows to serve the healing of the earth. And so when I returned from that training is when I had the vision to begin the studio. And kind of just things just started kind of unfolding from there.
Now, you've been an artist. You're trained as an artist as well.
Yes. I started drawing and painting at a young age and did my undergraduate work in fine arts. But I wasn't pursuing it professionally for a time. I suppose like a lot of young people, I got tired of being poor and, waiting tables. So I fell into graphic design for a time and had a very lucrative career doing that. And then around when I was around 41, I decided to, felt the call to work professionally as an artist at that point. So I'd already started in 2001, the year before the training with Joanna, to follow this soul calling to work professionally as an artist. But then when I did the training, that kind of solidified the vision for this work that I'm doing now.
Okay, so that really focused what your work would be to be sacred art.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is sacred art?
Good question. Well, we could look back into our history of art and humanity, and it goes back, you know, if you look at the Caves of Lascaux and throughout history, the goddess tradition, the great figurines. So it's a sense of the artist or giving expression to the divine through creation, through creating art. And so we've seen that throughout our lineage of human beings. And so I consider myself as part of that lineage of artists who have giving expression to the divine, the sacred, through art.
And, of course, that goes, as you mentioned, through a variety of religious traditions, whatever it is we call religion, spiritual traditions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We can look at the whole history of Christianity, certainly. I mean, very focused, beautiful madonnas and icon writing, paintings, and also in the Islamic tradition, beautiful mosques. I mean, the tiles and the calligraphy that they do. All expressions of God, the divine, you know, spirit. So
yeah, and as well as native traditions.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're beautiful weavings in the sand mandalas that they do. And
when we go to your studio, what will we see?
Well, a lot of color. I use vibrant colors in my work. And on one wall in particular, there's a very large-scale triptych called The Lovers of Creation, which is a revisioning of the Garden of Eden story through an indigenous lens.
Tell me more about that.
Mm-hmm. That was a painting that was inspired originally from my grief during the Gulf oil spill. So I was feeling very sorrowful and wanting to know nothing was really happening. No one was really addressing the spill at the beginning. And I was like, well, how have we come so separated from our place in the web of creation that we're allowing this to happen? And so I had this vision at the very center of the centerpiece, the mandala of this tree of life with a little embryo in the tree. And then it's connected to the tree, and the overarching theme being that the garden is right here, right now, not in a paradisal future. So, and then on either side are Adam and Eve wings, who represent the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine. The idea, the concept was to explore, you know, our original blessing that is right here, right now. Too often we're thinking about future times, you know, future Eden, future paradise, but paradise is right here, right here, right now, if we're present to that.
I like the phrase that you use, original blessing. I know the theologian and activist Matthew Fox wrote that book, how many years ago has it been now? In 83, I think it was, Original Blessing.
Yes.
And especially true with the Adam and Eve story, as it's often been used as original sin and fall and all of that kind of thing.
The fall redemption paradigm, which he completely rejects in his theology. Yeah. So, and I've studied quite a bit of his work and did some of my graduate work. My master's thesis was around creation spirituality, too. So it's, how do we shift the paradigm from a fall redemption to one that is around original blessing, our interconnectedness in the web of life, and serve the healing of our planet and other beings.
My guest is Amy Livingstone. She is the proprietor of the Sacred Art Studio, talking about sacred activism and sacred art. You talked about the grief of the oil spill.
Yeah.
And that really is central. The grief and the longing and the lament we feel, but we haven't been able to articulate. And you talk about breaking the heart open.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're being bombarded so much today with information about what's happening on the planet, ecologically, socially. There's just a lot of multiple crises that we're facing, the sixth mass extinction of species. Every day we're getting all this information, but we have no place to really process it. And that's why I think art has a really important role to play in creating spaces where we can experience those feelings and then have our heart broken open to the beauty of our world and to what it is we're losing, with the hope that it will inspire action. So in my work, in the last couple of years, 3 years, I've been creating installation work around that very notion of creating space for people to experience the grief.
Talk about the installation grid. How does that, that they themselves do some of the artwork, or how does that work?
Well, I do have an interactive nature mandala creation that we do together as a community, whoever attends the installation.
Mm-hmm.
But for instance, this year during Earth Week at PCC Sylvania, I had an installation called Memento Mori, Oceans in Crisis. And that was about plankton. And so it was really a memorial to plankton and trying to raise awareness and make visible what's invisible and how we're so intricately linked to these microscopic creatures that scientists say we've lost 40% of. I created the space where people could walk in and experience these images, and there was music. And so it really did invoke this feeling of grief. And then as they departed, they were invited to co-create this nature mandala, which is an offering of healing for the planet.
So this feeling of grief, when we think about 40% of the plankton gone, and yeah, I know that when I think about the Earth and all of the crises that we're facing and the props impending collapse of civilization in that industrial civilization, it can be despairing.
Mm-hmm.
How do we transition? How does art help us keep going?
Mm-hmm. Well, my teacher, Joanna Macy, one of my teachers, she does wonderful, amazing work around grief and empowerment work. So the idea, I think the fear is that if we go into the grief, that we get stuck in the grief. But we don't. It's really allowing ourselves to really feel the feelings and then move through them. Otherwise, we just push them away, try to repress them, you know, make everything happy, you know, and then it comes out in other ways. Maybe
right.
Addiction to shopping or the need for more material things instead of maybe a spiritual life or finding ways to be of service and that kind of thing. So it's really about knowing that because you're feeling it doesn't mean you have to stay stuck in it. It's and be inspired instead.
If we aren't really conscious of it, then we're stuck.
Right, yeah.
As you say, the breaking of the heart open is really the freeing, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, that's been my experience. I'm not just saying that for just off the top of my head. I've experienced this myself personally in my own life, having gone through some profound losses around when I was 29, 30 years old. My brother died from AIDS, and then my mother died suddenly 9 months later. And
oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. It was really a dark, very dark period in my life. And it took a really long time for me to journey through that because everyone kept telling me that life goes on. And I'm like, no, life goes on, but goes on differently. And so that feeling of being stuck in it didn't allow me to move through it. There was no real support. So I really do believe in the power of witnessing, which later on I did find that with a therapist and through my own art making. So I believe in the power of art making for all of us to process grief. I think in any form, putting color on paper, collaging, doing anything can be very profoundly healing, and then being witness too, as well.
Witness, talk about that. What do you mean by witness?
Someone to bear witness to your grief, and that's why I think these installations and others, I mean, when we think about the Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial, how profoundly healing that was for our Vietnam vets. I mean, because you could go, you could be present at this wall and feel your grief, and there are others there holding that space with you. So it's about not being alone. We have to grieve together.
So we're bearing witness to one another's experience.
Exactly.
Of the ache and the pain and the struggle and the grief of life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we get isolated in our culture when it comes to grief and death and dying. And that it's important to move beyond that.
Soul symbol mandala or mandala?
That's a good question. I hear that often, actually. It's pronounced both ways. I've heard the Tibetans say mandala and others mandala, so either one is good.
So how you say it, okay. And what do you do with that? What is that?
Well, those are specific commissioned works that I've created for people, and it's really such a joy and an honor to do this for, so far it's been women, but it would be fun to do one for a man as well, who's out there on his own spiritual journey. So I meet either live, you know, one face-to-face or via Skype, and I have a conversation with them. I listen to their story and get images of kind of where they are in their life, you know, what appeals to them. So I try to kind of draw up the symbolism from their life and their journey. Then I create these specific mandalas, icons, basically, that are symbolize, you know, who they are and where they are in their life, and they can meditate with them and I found it very healing for people. It's really very, very profound, actually.
If you were just joining us, my guest is Amy Livingstone. She is the host of the Sacred Art Studio. Her website is sacredartstudio.net. You know, activism is hard to sustain. So burned out activists is common. Have you worked then with kind of people on that scale who've really just been out there doing the activist work? And then feeling a little exhausted by it all.
Well, I have many friends who are out there working on the front lines with climate and various ecological crises and whatnot. So there is a level of burnout that happens. But, and so that's where I think sacred activism, which I borrow from Andrew Harvey, who's a mystic and writer and spiritual teacher. He's amazing. The sacred activism allows for create space for the creative, the spiritual practices to help us support us. So how do we find practices that can support us in the work, whether that's meditation or creative practices or time in nature, just taking breaks periodically, self-care.
Sometimes we can be so active and overwhelmed, we forget mm-hmm. that part.
Exactly. Another wonderful voice who I'm really appreciating is Rebecca Solnit. She's out of the Bay Area, and I just heard her interviewed again as well recently. And her book she wrote specifically for activists, because so many of them were feeling burnt out and like not being effective in their work and such. So she became a little frustrated, from what I can tell, because they weren't really looking at the history of activism. They weren't understanding their own history, our own history. So how we've all, throughout our history, have people like the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the suffragettes. I mean, she kind of outlays all this whole history of things that have been positive changes in the right direction. So she inspires me, and Hope in the Dark looks at, very much, being with the dark, being with that, but also finding hope too through our actions.
And spiritual ecology is one of the phrases that I found on your website, mm-hmm. that our ecological crisis is a spiritual crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, spiritual ecology is a kind of a new term that's come up over the last few years and addresses the ecological crisis. Like deep ecology, which was also another term for this awareness of our interdependence in the life web concept. Spiritual ecology is a new term that's being used to address the spiritual aspects of the ecological crisis. So a lot of what we're experiencing right now is this disconnect that we have, the separation from the planet, from the web of life, from our own communities. It's just so the spiritual ecology addresses the crisis through that lens versus a material scientific lens, right? So if that makes sense.
The idea of thinking that we are separate from Earth, that Earth mm-hmm. is a collection of resources for us to use or exploit, as opposed to being we actually are nature.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so I resonate with the movement that's around spiritual ecology, because it does bring in the spiritual aspects of this, our connection to the Earth and our interdependence.
Tell me a little bit more about the installations mm-hmm. that you do.
Okay. Well, the first one that I created was around the Lovers of Creation, which I'd already mentioned to you, the large-scale triptych around mm-hmm. the Garden of Eden story. So that was an installation that was at PCC Sylvania originally in 2013. And so what I wanted to create in that space was a feeling that the garden is right here, right now. And so there was the installation included the Lovers of Creation. There was a beauty wall. There was also a mourning wall for on the other side, where people could experience some of their heartache around some of the species. That's what I was focusing on, because the centerpiece of this triptych are four endangered species: polar bear, spotted owl, tiger, and salmon. So it's shining a light on the plight of endangered species. And so the mourning wall addresses the kind of the statistics, the images of what it is, like the poaching of the tigers and the melting ice caps. So there's that space for that. And then in the center, had the mandala, the nature mandala, where people could co-create that and add prayers of healing for the planet and other creatures.
Some people, I'll put myself in this category, are not trained in art as such and may not think that they're very good at it, or rather embarrassed about it. So what about us non-artists, so to speak? How can we discover, what would you suggest for a beginner in terms of finding their creative side?
Well, first of all, I think we're all artists of some kind. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons why I'm drawn to Creation Spirituality with Matthew Fox. It's because at the very center of that tradition is the role of art and creativity in our lives to serve our not only healing, but healing of others and what so. But so I think we all have a gift. We may not paint and draw and do the things that I do, but there's a lot of ways to be creative. Cooking and gardening are amazing ways to connect to the earth and create beauty. I mean, it's a lot about it's creating beauty for me and beauty in our worlds and our spaces. So, but a simple thing to start with would be collaging. That's a simple way to put something down. It doesn't require a lot of materials, just some magazines and scissors and glue. And I've seen a lot of really beautiful collages. So,
and you really kind of find out what is in you outside of kind of the logical thinking side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a way to discover what's really going on inside you that you haven't been in touch with.
Mm-hmm. And connect to your heart. I mean, we live in a world that's so, I mean, our heads are disconnected from our bodies, you know, it's everything's very mental. And I mean, I'm the same way. I mean, I love, you know, literature and all those things. So I enjoy an intellectual life, but art can bring it all right into the heart, just in that creative process. And the biggest challenge probably for people is to overcome the internal critic, that it has to be perfect, that it has to look a certain way. So learning to let go of that, which isn't always easy, but it's a practice, and all practices take time.
Right. You have to just keep kind of trying and going at it.
Exactly.
And doing it.
Yeah.
And accepting yourself and what that is
mm-hmm.
about.
Right.
Amy Livingstone has been my guest. She is the proprietor of the Sacred Art Studio. Her website is sacredartstudio.net. Amy, thanks so much for your work and for being with me today.
Great being here. Thanks, John.
You've been listening to The Beloved Community. For more information about The Beloved Community and my weekly podcast, Progressive Spirit, go to progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network, I'm John Schott. Be well.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goals of justice and freedom. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.